All right, we are holding on page Memtes in Shabbos, the last line, middle of Osayin Beis. We started discussing yesterday, Gemara was talking about that if a person is if a person doesn't bother joining in the Hesped for a Talmud Chacham, then there are very serious consequences. And we give as an example of that how what happened after Yeshua passed away, where they didn't, the Pasuk doesn't make a point of mentioning that they mourned for him. And therefore, then the Pasuk implies that the mountain over there quaked or erupted and threatened to bury them. So we said also, the last thing we said also was that now the Pasuk mentioned that there were the Zakenim who lived long after Yeshua, which implies that they lived long as opposed to before. We said that Rabbi Chiya bar Abba quoted in the name of Rabbi Yechanan that a person who's like that, who doesn't get himself involved in the Hesped of a Talmud Chacham, won't live long. So Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, having quoted that in the name of Rabbi Yechanan, asked Rabbi Yechanan, what about them? The Pasuk is saying that they lived long, and Rabbi Yechanan answers him, they only lived long years, but not long days. Which we said, Rashi explains that it means that they didn't live much longer in time, but the time that they still had left, they enjoyed it. They had they were healthy and comfortable or whatever. It just didn't last very long. Marsha says the other way around, they lived many years, but those years were with troubles and sicknesses and difficulties and whatnot. By the way, I was thinking afterwards yesterday of a possible limud schus. We were talking about yesterday why the Taka didn't make a hesped for Yeshua, why they didn't mourn him so much. One possible reason that occurred to me is we find the Gemara tells us in Tmura that during the time when they were mourning for Moshe Rabbeinu, it says in the Pasuk at the end of Parshas, at the end of the Zos HaBracha, that they were mourning for him for 30 days. During that time, the Gemara says they forgot thousands of details of halachas. Some of them it says Osnio ben Knaz was able to reconstruct with his pupil. Some of them remain lost forever. Maybe the Yidden figured that if they have too much grief over Yeshua passing away, then they're in danger of the same thing happening all over again. So that might be a certain limud schos on them. Anyway, so the Gemara says, if you're telling me that whenever it says ha'arichu yomim, then it means that it was only yomim and not shanim, as Rabbi Yochanan just answered Rabbi Chiya bar Abba, then elamayata, by that logic, what about at the end of Kriyishma? We say, l'man yibu yimeichem b'meivenechem, that your days and the days of your children should be increased, should be lengthened. Are you going to say also yomim v'lo shanim? You're going to say also that Be'er Hashem is promising that you're only going to have yomim and not shanim, meaning, again, according to Rashi, not a long life, but a pleasant one, or according to Marsha, the other way around, a long life, but an unpleasant one. And the answer is that's different. Bracha shiny. It's different when it's a bracha. Obviously, a bracha is meant to be the best possible thing, so therefore, we're not going to understand l'man yibu yimeichem mimei v'neichem in that restricted sense. On the other hand, when it says about Yeshua and the Zakenim who lived after him, we should more logically assume that if it actually meant that they lived both long and happy years, then it should have phrased it differently. It didn't even have to say Asher Harichu Yamim. It could have said some other expression, or it could have said Asher Harichu Yamim B'Shanim or whatever, and therefore we should assume that it means only one and not the other, and that was because they failed to do a proper hesped for Yeshua. The Gemara continues, if you have a bunch of brothers and one of them passed away, all of the other brothers should be afraid that, Rashi says, mina misa, they should be afraid of death. One of them might be next. Meaning, in other words, Marasha says that they should be davening for extra rachamim from Hashem, because now they were struck by the midas adin, then therefore now they have to be davening for more rachamim to counteract that. As similarly, he continues, Echad mimnei chavura shemes, if one member of a group passed away, same way, tidag kola chavura kola, that entire group should have to be concerned, and the same thing, they should be davening for more rachamim from Hashem, that they shouldn't be next. So Amri lo demes gadol, some say that the main concern is if the greatest or the eldest of them passed away. You could say, Rashi said, since the midas adin affected the greatest of them, so maybe the other ones who are on a lesser level could be next, chas v'shalom. But Amri lo demes katan, others say on the contrary, when the least important or the youngest passed away, because we find the Gemara has an expression elsewhere, beklala maschilin min hakatan. When it comes to a punishment or a curse, often Hashem begins with the least important. We find by Adam and Chava and the snake, where first Hashem goes and curses the snake and only then works his way up to Chava and Adam. So in the same thing over here, if the klala is affecting the least important of them, then that may mean that this is the beginning of something that's going to end up affecting the rest of them, chas v'shalom. Actually, Ion Yaakov points out that really, We're not saying, and what happens if one of the middle ones passes away? You're also there's also reason to be concerned. What we're saying is that either way, really what the Gemara is saying is we can't be sure which order it goes in, whether it's from least important to most important or vice versa. And therefore, really, no matter what order it happens in, ultimately, yidagu, they should be concerned about it and be davening for extra rachamim and work to earn themselves more zchusim. Okay. Further on, towards the end of the perek, it starts talking about the halachas of trapping animals on Shabbos. We know that's one of the 39 halachas tzeda, so it starts dealing with the halachas of that. One thing it mentions is that if you get a bird into a house, for example, that's not considered tzeda, because the bird can easily flit around from one corner to the other. Only if you get it like into a closet where it can't easily get around, then that would be considered the actual malacha d'araisa of tzeda. So in this connection, the Gemara asks why. Now, on the face of it, even with some kinds of birds, you get them into the house, then that's it. They feel they're in captivity, and they're not going to try to fly away anymore. So why are we saying that if you get a bird into a house, it's not considered a malacha of tzeda? So the Gemara says, "Amar Rabba Bar Rav Huna Hocha B'tzipor Drur Askinan." Specifically, we're talking about over here a tzipor drur. Now, there's a few different opinions among the Rishonim what exactly a tzipor dror is. There are some Rishonim who learn that it's a specific species of bird. Some say a swallow, some say a sparrow. And then the Ramban says it's not necessarily any specific type. It just means more generally you have certain kinds of small birds that, as the Gemara is going to say, they're never really tameable. They're never really domesticable. And no matter what, they're always going to try to get away from you. So therefore, that would be the general term of tzipor dror. He says it doesn't mean any specific species. Anyway, so here we're talking about tzipor dror l'fisha enim kabelas morus, because it never accepts human domination, no matter what. It's never really domesticable, no matter what. It's always going to try to get away from people. And tonet vei Rabbi Shmuel. In fact, we learn in a brisa from the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, lomen nikra tzipor dror. Why indeed is this type of bird called a tzipor dror? The word dror literally means freedom, like you have in last week's parasha, crossing dror ba'aretz l'chol yoshveh. But why is the word dror specifically a word for freedom? Shadara kabayis kabasada, because it lives just as much in the house as it does out in the field, meaning the same way as in the field, it feels free to fly everywhere. The same way, even if it's trapped inside the house, it's also going to feel free to get everywhere that it can and to try to stay away from people. Peshut Agadta points out an interesting thing behind this. He says, a house, sometimes we find it as a metaphor for bina. So therefore, the tzipor dror that lives just as comfortably in the house as in the field represents a person who, despite the fact that he has great bina, he still has the bittul and the kabbalas oil towards Hashem, rather than taking on human, rather than taking on bittul to be accepted, he'll be dominated by a fellow human being. He realizes the only one who has control of him is Hashem, just like the bird feels, and therefore, even when he's in the bias of bina, he still feels that way, and he doesn't think that he knows everything.
Is there a
Golas
of Eden that was 410 years?
A Golas that was 410 years. 410 is the time that the first Beis Hamikdash stood. The first Beis Hamikdash stood 410 years. Yeah, the Gematria Dror is 410. Yeah, I think Bala Turim points out that there you have a remez in the Pasuk, which is across from Dror, but Olof Kol Yeshveh, that it means that their Kol Yeshveh were there for 410 years. That's not really precise. I mean, the fact is, 100 odd years before Churban Bayis Rishon, the Aseres HaTshevatim were taken into Golos, and the Yovlos were suspended until you have shortly before the Churban, Yirmiyahu brought many of them back, and then there was one more Yovel before the Churban. So strictly speaking, there weren't Yovlos the entire 410 years of the first Beis Hamikdash. But yeah, anyway, it's a rem, as he says. Okay. Shmona Shrots in Perek Arba'asar. So the beginning of the Perek continues with dinim about the malachas involving animals. In particular, you have among the malachas is, among the 39 malachas, is shechet, is shechting an animal, and a tolda of that is wounding an animal. So therefore, so the Mishnah starts talking. Now you have like this, and then you have like this. The Mishnah makes a distinction between animals that have a tough skin, animals or people for that matter, who have a tough skin, versus creatures that do not. The difference being that a person, for example, it's possible to injure them in a way where there's a bruise, and the bruise never really, there's always a scar left under the skin because the blood collects under the skin, and it never really fully heals. There's always a mark left of it. And similarly with many kinds of animals and birds and even certain small animals that are among the Shmona Shnatzim are also in that category. As opposed to you have other ones that don't really have hard skins. Their skins are very soft. They're basically just an extension of their flesh. There's no such thing as bruising them, really. Either you hit them hard enough for blood to come out, or you don't, and then the blood just collects in a place, and then afterwards gets reabsorbed into the body. So that's a distinction as far as the malacha of shochet, when a person would be chayev and when not. So in this connection, then the Gemara digresses to talk about now we have part of the malacha of shochet is killing animals. So then the Gemara deals with the question of, are you allowed to kill lice on Shabbos? Now, one point the Gemara makes is as we're going to see over here in this piece, is that lice are not part of a rub. They don't mate male and female and have babies the way that most creatures do. They just, the Gemara considers it that they just come from sweat, basically. They form spontaneous generation from sweat. There's a good deal of discussion about that because in the last few hundred years, scientists discovered, or at least they say that they discovered, that there's no such thing as spontaneous generation, that every creature comes from some previous living creature. So how does this affect this halacha? In fact, you have the Pachad Yitzchak, who lived in Italy a few hundred years ago. He taka says, maybe based on that, now that we know differently, maybe the halacha has to change. Maybe it would be also Daraisa to kill lice on Shabbos because now we know that they do in fact come from eggs, from microscopic eggs. On the other hand, there are other achronim we'll talk about that precisely because those eggs are microscopic, therefore they don't have significance in Torah. Torah only deals with what we can see with the naked eye, and therefore, as far as Torah is concerned, we can say that they're spontaneously generated, even if scientifically, if you look at them under a microscope, you find that not. Anyway, so the Gemara deals with this issue of killing lice on Shabbos. So in this connection, the Gemara discusses, don't we say that lice have eggs? And if they have eggs, that implies that they come from parents, that they grow and they develop in the way that most creatures do. So Omamar, we learn in a Braisa that in Masechta Avodah Zarah at the beginning, that it discusses over there Hashem's daily schedule, what he does throughout the day, this quarter of the day, that quarter of the day. So it mentions Yosheva Kodesh Baruch Hu Vizon Mikanu Re'emim Bad Beit Zekinim. Hashem sits and sustains, meaning Hashem decides what each creature should have for food from the horns of Re'emim, which a Re'em is a very tall, powerful creature. Some say it's a rhinoceros, some say that it's an aurochs, which is a type of extinct ox, whatever, different possibilities. Va'ad Beit Zekinim, until the eggs of lice, which sounds like it means that lice lay eggs. And in that case, then they are part of a rubber. So they should be just like any other animal. And you can't, it would be an iser daraisa to kill them on Shabbos. So the Ein Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Ibn Chaviv, points out, primarily this statement is in the first parak of Avodah Zarah, but the true meaning of Beit Zekinim emerges only from this sugya. So therefore, he says it's appropriate to put these two parts together. Instead of having the part about Hashem supporting the Beit Zekinim all the way in Avodah Zarah, and here you're only going to have the point what Beit Zekinim means, and you would have a hard time putting them together, better to put them both together over here. So this is how it says in Avodah Zarah. The daytime lasts for 12 hours. Gimel shows Rishonis during the first 3 hours. Yosheva Kodesh Baruch Hu va'osek b'Torah. Hashem sits and studies and occupies himself with Torah. Shnius, during the second 3 hours, Yosheva b'Donis kol olam kulo v'chula. Hashem sits and judges the entire world. In fact, the Gemara there brings possibilities that maybe it's the other way around. Maybe first Hashem judges and then he learns Torah after that. And in fact, there's a halacha that comes out of that, which is that you're davening on Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. If you're davening B'Yechidus, you shouldn't daven Musaf until after 3 hours of the day, because you shouldn't be davening during the time when Hashem is judging. Mashenken the Tzibur, Hashem treats the Tzibur more mercifully anyway, so there's not so much of an issue with it. Anyway, he continues. Shlishis Yosheva Kodesh Baruch Hu Bezonis Kol Olam Kol Loy. During the third group of hours, Hashem sits and sustains the entire world. Mikanu Re'emim Vad Beit Sekinim, from the horns of the Re'emim until the eggs of lice. Ad Kan, and that's and then it goes on to talk about in the Gemara over there what Hashem does during the fourth quarter of the day. Anyway, the point is, over Mokem Hazeh L'Inyan Dina, here in Masech the Shabbos, there's a din that's relevant to Dahod Kinev Shabbos. The question about, are you allowed to kill lice on Shabbos? So Amar Rav Yosef, to ain't a part of a rubber. So Rav Yosef, in our sugya here in Shabbos, points out that lice are not part of a rubber. They don't come from a male and a female. So now the question is, Amalei Abayas. Abayas says, "Kina ain't part of a rubber." What are you telling me that lice don't? We're speaking of eggs of lice. Eggs implies that they come from a parent. It doesn't even have to be maybe a male and female parent. You could have, you know, certain kinds of creatures reproduce. It's called parthenogenesis, where they come only from a female by herself. But nonetheless, the point is that you see that the fact is, at least you have eggs, implies that they come from a parent, not just that they come from spontaneous generation. There is, by the way, I should mention in that connection with that whole discussion about spontaneous generation, again, you have the Pachad Yitzchak saying that maybe in fact we have to say the halacha is different now that we know the scientific facts are different. And you have others that say that no, the Gemara is only dealing with what we can see with the naked eye. There's a third point that Eben makes in some letters. Just because scientists say that they've done experiments and they haven't found that spontaneous generation happens, doesn't mean it's impossible for it to happen. They haven't found, but nonetheless, that doesn't negate the possibility. Anyway. So Abaya says, if eggs have lice, and we say that, as we see, we're describing Beit Sekinim, then, I mean, if lice have eggs, and we say Beit Sekinim, then that implies that they come from a parent. So how can you say that you're allowed to kill them on Shabbos? So the answer is no. Minuhu demikrit Beit Sekinim. You should understand the word Beit Sekinim does not mean eggs of lice, as in the lice lay eggs and Hashem sustains them. It means that there's an actual species that are called Beit Sekinim. They're called eggs of lice, pashtus, because they look more like eggs. But in fact, they are a separate species, whereas the lice themselves, we're saying, come or are spontaneously generated. So the Gemara asks, "Vatanya tafuyeu beit sekinim?" Don't we have though another brisa, which mentions tafuyim, which is another type of insect, and beit sekinim? And apparently that would imply that Vahatanya actually is a statement. Vahatanya, and indeed we have a brisa that mentions tafuyu beit sekinim, that mentions these as two types of insects. Rashi says, by the way, I don't know where this brisa is. Anaf Yosef brings that it actually comes from Tonad Veil Yohu, talking about Makas Kinim in Mitzrayim, that it says over there, Hashem brought against them 14 different types of lice, and among them it mentions these Tefuya and Beit Sekinim. So we see that Beit Sekinim, Minahu Demikri, Beit Sekinim, so we see it's a separate species. We're not saying that Hashem brought eggs of lice against the Mitzrayim, because why would that bother them? It means he brought against them regular lice, as well as the other kind that are called Beit Sekinim. But they're not in fact the eggs of lice, but rather a separate species of lice. So we see then that just because it mentions Beit Sekinim doesn't mean they're part of a rubber.
I saw in the Sefer Mitzvot there's some kind of a bird that it formed by itself in an old fruit.
Not birds actually, but they're not right. The Rambam mentions in connection, right? The Rambam mentions in connection with the halachos of eating insects that you have insects that for insects or worms or whatever that form in fruit. And those are also to eat. There's a lav in the Torah against eating those. Yeah, and the Rambam makes the same point. There needs to be a separate lav for them because they're not part of a rubber. Again, you have the same.
Big bird.
No, it's not a bird. It's a type of insect or worm or something.
He
says sheretz ha'oif. The expression sheretz ha'oif means flying insects. So again, you have the same kind of discussion. Does that mean nowadays we know differently and in fact those do form from eggs? Or is it that maybe not, scientists have not necessarily proved that definitively, or is it that they do form from eggs, but they're microscopic eggs and they don't have any relevance in halacha? But whatever, the din is still a din. Yeah, but it's not talking about birds. It means sheretz ha'oif means flying insects. Yeah. Okay, anyway. What's the relevance of this? Why do we need this in Ein Yaakov? So HaKosev, which is a commentary by the compiler of Ein Yaakov himself.
The edge of getting away from the teacher-centered lecture.
Some idiot out there was playing his music or whatever passes for music. What? Anyway. why is this important to know? And why is this part of Ein Yaakov? Why is this an Agadah? So HaKosev, which is the commentary by the compiler of Ein Yaakov himself, he explains that we get from this like this. Before the Baal Shem Tov's times, the general understanding among most Gdolei Yisrael was that when we talk about Hashgacha Pratis, that's primarily on people, and particularly only on people who've reached a certain level of closeness to Hashem. Other than that, they held in general, when it comes to animal life and whatnot, there's only Hashgacha Klavos. Hashem has a general Hashgacha over the species, that the species shouldn't go extinct until Hashem decides that it's time for it to, but not necessarily that any individual animal or worm or louse or what have you is specifically determined what its life plan is going to be. So therefore he says, this Gemara fits with that point, that was saying there is a species, there's a species called lice, kinim, and there's a separate species called betzik kinim that are called eggs of lice, even though they're not eggs, they're just that the name of them. And we're saying that Hashem takes care of each of those species individually, but not necessarily of the individual one, until the Baal Shem Tov came along and he made it more the more mainstream idea that there's Hashgacha Pratis individually on every creature and even on the movement of every leaf. And eventually that became the mainstream understanding among most segments of the Jewish people. The Rambam, for example, mentions that point in Moreh Nevuchim and says he doesn't hold of it, but eventually the Baal Shem Tov came and made it more mainstream. Mm-hmm. Next, the Gemara goes on to talk about, since we're mentioning in the Mishnah again that you have various kinds of birds and animals and whatnot that have tough skin, and therefore that's relevant as far as the halachas of Shabbos, like we were talking about. So that leads the Gemara into a discussion of which of those, what kinds of skins can you use to write Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzahs. So the Gemara discusses in that connection, can you use the skins of birds, for example? Are their skins considered actual skins to the extent that you could use them for Sefer Torah, Tefillin, and Mezuzahs? What about fish? And it goes on with a whole discussion. So in that connection now, the Gemara brings now the Gemara establishes in that connection, and now we're going to discuss it in this story over here, that the fact is you can only use the skins of kosher animals or birds for Sefer Torah, Tefillin, Mezuzahs, not ones from non-kosher animals. So that's going to emerge from this story. So the Gemara tells Shmuel v'Karna have a yasvi agudah in a harmalka. Shmuel and Karna were sitting once by the banks of the Malka River. Karna, we find in a number of places in Shas. He was as we see over here, he was a chaver of Shmuel. The Gemara especially mentions that he was an expert in dini mominus. In fact, the Gemara in a couple of places mentions Nizikin de Beit Karna, a whole collection of braises on Seder Nizikin that he compiled. So that was his area of expertise in halacha. But we also find the Gemara mentions in Pesugos as well that he had for his profession to earn a living, he was a professional wine smeller. People would invite him to come to their wine cellars to smell which barrels of wine are going to spoil soon, so they would know to sell those faster. So that was his profession. And then besides that, he was a big Talmid Chacham. So now one time he and Shmuel then are sitting by the banks of Nahar Malka. The Ben Yoyada says Nahar Malka may refer to the Pros River, but either that or it means that it's one of the many canals or smaller rivers or whatever they had involved. Anyway, Chazinu L'maya de Kodolu V'achiv. They saw that the water of the river was lifting up. There were high waves forming and that the water was cloudy. As if it was turbulent and there was sediment stirred up. Omele Shmuel Lekarna, so Shmuel says to Karna, I can tell from that, Gavra Rabba Ka'osi Mimarava, a great person, a great Yid, is coming from the west, from Eretz Yisrael, V'chayish Mimei, and he has a stomach ache, he has stomach problems, V'kodolu Mayalak Bule Ape Kamei. The water, the waves, is lifting up to greet them. Meaning, so Rashi explains, because this person who's coming, and Shmuel doesn't yet know who it is, because he has stomach trouble, therefore he's having to go to the bathroom a lot. So therefore, Hashem is making that the waves are lifting up in his honor. That way, when he has to go over the side of the boat, then you have the waves are helping cover him up so people don't have to see him. To give him privacy. And also, Rashi explains, also they help him to wipe afterwards. That's according to Rashi. Tosfos has a problem with that. The Tosfos has a different girsa of the Gemara and explains, brings from Rabbeinu Hanano, which actually the explanation goes back to Rabbi Haigoin. is that it's the other way around. The cause and effect is the other way around. So the problem is, Tosfos says, how does that, I mean, so the waves are lifting up. It could be in order to give the person on the boat some privacy. It could be equally well be for some other reason. How does Shmuel know specifically it's for the purpose of giving him privacy? So therefore, Tosfos says, no. What it means is Shmuel knew that this person, whoever it is he had heard from other people that a great yid, a great tzaddik, or a great Talmud Chacham is coming on the boat. Now, Shmuel realized because the water is turbulent, because there's a storm and the water is getting stirred up, because of that, there's more sediment in the water than usual. And therefore, this Gavra Rabba, this great person, if he ends up drinking that water, it's going to end up giving him a stomachache. So it's not that now he has a stomachache and therefore, and the water is giving him privacy. It's the other way around. When he drinks from that water, inevitably he's going to get a stomachache, Shmuel was saying.
Is ocean water?
No, it was a river, but there was a river. Normally the river would flow calmly and there wouldn't be much sediment in it, so it would be clean water to drink. But now, because Tosfos is learning from Rabbeinu Hananel that because the waves are being whipped up by the wind or whatever it is, therefore there's more sediment in the water than usual, and therefore this great yid, when he drinks from that water, is going to end up having a stomachache, and I, as the Gemara is going to go on to say, Shmuel was an expert doctor, and going to have to cure him. So that's Tosfos' explanation. So he has the cause and effect, the opposite of Rashi. Marsha has yet another explanation. Marsha says even Tosfos' explanation is a little bit of a doif. So he says, no, it's true like Rashi says, that Shmuel knew that that great person who's coming has a stomachache. Shmuel also figured that that same great person is going to come to him, to Shmuel, to be cured. Because after all, Shmuel was known to be an expert doctor. So therefore, so now when he sees that the water is lifting up, showing the waves are lifting up, showing that they're coming to honor that great Talmud Chacham, then he goes to, he tells Karna, go find out who that is and invite him to my house so that I can cure him. Anyway, so Amalei Shmuel, so Shmuel tells him, Gavra Rabba Ka'osi Mimah Rabba, a great person is coming from the west, from Eretz Yisrael, V'chayish B'meya, he has a stomachache. Again, according to Rashi, I know already that he has a stomachache, and that's why the water was lifting up. According to Tosfos, on the contrary, he's going to get a stomachache from drinking the water. V'kadolu Mayalak Bulei Api, so the water is lifting up to greet him. Zil Tohile Akankane, go check him out, whether he's a Talmud Chacham or not. Meaning, Ben Yoyada says, I may know that he's a Gavra Rabba, but a Gavra Rabba could have many meanings. It could mean that he's great in mitzvahs. It could mean that he's a great tzaddik. I want to find out whether he's in fact a great Talmud Chacham. The expression tohi le'akankani literally means smell his barrel. So that's why Shmuel is using this expression to Karna, since Karna's profession was smelling barrels of wine. So therefore he uses it metaphorically, go smell him, beruchnius, to find out, go sniff him out and see whether he's a Talmud Chacham. Also, Ashkechei l'Rav. So Karna went and he found that it was Rav. Rav lived, was originally from Babel. He lived in Eretz Yisrael much of his life. Eventually, in his old age, he returned to Babel, and this is now who's coming. Omerlei, so Karna starts peppering Rav with questions. The first question he asks him, Minayin chain, this is why this is in the Sugya, Minayin chain kosvin tefillin elau gabi ur behema tohora. How do we know that you can write tefillin only on the skin of a kosher animal? So Rav answers him, Dichtiv, Laman tia teras Hashem b'ficha. The pasuk says, in order that the word of Hashem should be in your mouth, and that implies, Minam mutu l'ficha or b'ficha, it implies it has to be written on something which is mutter for you to eat. So if it was the skin of a non-kosher animal, you wouldn't be allowed to eat it. Therefore, that shows that it has to be from a kosher animal. Next, Karna asks him, Minayin l'dam shehu adayim. How do we know that blood in halacha is considered, means dafka has to be red? This is Negea, Rashi explains, as far as the halachas of Nida. Not every discharge that comes from a woman's uterus is metameher. It has to be one of the Mishnah in Nida describes there are five specific shades that it is. Technically, and in principle, that would be nowadays the Rabbanim don't have the expertise to be able to tell so much between one shade and another. So whenever you have something that has a tinge of red, then generally they declare it Tameh. But in principle, the Gemara explains over there would only be specific shades. So actually, of the five, four of them are shades of red. The fifth one is actually black, but the Gemara explains that the black blood is actually red blood that spoiled, that deteriorated. So it was red originally. you know, got deoxygenated and it's spoiled or whatever, and therefore turned black. The point is that the basic color of blood in halacha is considered to be red. We don't say, for example, that discharges of other colors should be metame. Where do we get that from? So Rav answers Shenema, because the pasuk says, "Vayiru moyav mineged samayim adumim kadam." Moyav saw the Moyavi soldiers saw from afar the water looking red like blood. The context of this is a story in Sefer Melachim that the king of Yehuda, Yehoshaphat, the king of Yisrael, Yehoram, and the king of Edom, who wasn't actually a king, he was a governor appointed by the king of Yehuda. They were all traveling through the desert on their way to fight Moab. They're running out of water. So they go to Elisha to ask him to help them. So Elisha tells them there's going to be a ness. Hashem is going to make it rain in the land of Edom, and the water is going to flow to this area over here and fill up pits that you're going to dig pits in the ground, and the water is going to fill them up, and you'll have plenty of water for yourselves and your animals. And on top of that, Hashem will also help you defeat Moab. So what happens? The pasuk goes on to describe that, yeah, it rained in Edom. The water flowed towards their encampment in the desert and filled up their ditches that they dug. Meanwhile, when the Moavim came there the next morning, they saw that they weren't used to, they there's no water there generally. All of a sudden, they see pools on the ground. And in the light of the sun, the pools looked red. So they thought these are pools of blood. They thought that the three armies of Yisrael, Yehuda, and Edom had all had a civil war between them, and they all defeated each other. And now all we may often have to do is walk in there, and the spoils are all ours. And they go in there unprepared, and then the three armies finish them off.
What do they do nowadays with the color yellow?
So yellow is a question. Some, it depends really whether the yellow has a reddish tinge or not. I think more in general, Rabbanim will usually say that yellow is a problem, but you have to ask each individual Rav. Anyway. So the point is that we're saying that the Moavim saw that water looking red like blood. So the fact that the pasuk makes a point of mentioning red like blood shows that the color of blood in halacha is red and no other color. Anyway, then... Karna asks him another one. Minayim l'mila shabaose makom. How do we know that mila is done dafka on that part of the body, on the male organ? After all, the pasuk only says umaltim es psaro laschem. It never actually identifies in so many words the part of the body. So how do we know that it's dafka there? So Ram answers him. Nemer kan or losay v'nemer lahalan or losay, because we have a gzeira shabu. We have the word orlosoi, the oral zohar, the yimel psaro losoi, the nemel halon orlosoi. In connection with orla of trees, it also uses the word orlosoi. Malahalon, dovasha, is a pri. Just like over there by trees, we're talking about a tree that produces fruit. Afkan, dovasha, is a pri. Here also, it has to be the part of the body that produces fruit, that produces offspring. So therefore, it has to be the male organ. So Karna asks him still, Ema Liboy, how do we know specifically that it means that part of the body? Maybe you could say that it means the heart. After all, we find Orla in connection with the heart. Moshe tells the Jewish people you have to circumcise the uncircumcision of your heart. Rashi, by the way, in a number of places mentions that the basic meaning of Orla is covered up, is blocked. Like Orla is called that because the fruit is blocked from use for 3 years. So the same way Moshe is telling the people, you have a blockage on your heart that's preventing you from being sensitive to Orla. Of course, you have to cut through that blockage. But maybe it literally means that Mila should take place over there. Now, some of the Mephoshim say that at this point, Rav realizes that Kauna is just kind of there to harass him with questions. Because come on, seriously, how could you do Mila on the heart without killing the person? On the other hand, Eitz Yosef says, listen, you could say maybe not the heart itself, of course, but you could say like one of the blood vessels that leads to the heart or something. Maybe you're supposed to cut away a little part of it or something. Yeah. Anyway, how do you...
Not only that, the heart is not producing sperm to make a baby.
Well, that's true. But even so, he's saying, the fact is, if we're learning a Gzeira Shava from Orlosoi, the fact is we have other places where it uses the word Orla. So how do we know we don't use a Gzeira Shava from one of those? That's the point. And similarly, Ema Oznai, maybe you could say that the Orla means the Orla of the ear, Dichtiv Hine Arela Oznam, as we find that the Navi accuses the Jewish people and says their ears are stopped up, they don't want to listen to the Nevuas. So we see the word Orla is used in connection with those parts of the body as well. So Rav answers him, fine, but Donin Orlose Tama me Orlose Tama. We're going to learn a Gzeira Shava. It's true. We may not know what the other end of the Gzeira Shava is, but we're going to learn the word Orlosoi, the complete word Orlosoi, is Orla, from another place where it says the complete word Orlosoi. As opposed to your examples by the heart and by the ear, it only says Orla or Arela without the suf and the vav at the end. So it's not exactly the same words. If we have a choice where to make the Gzeira Shava from, then we're going to learn it from that. Why Taka is kind of picking these particular things to ask Rav? So Benayahu, which is the Ben Ishchai, wrote a number of Sfarim. He wrote famously Ben Yehoyada on the Gemara, and then he followed it up with another sefer called Benayahu, where he has more chidushim on the Agadah in the Gemara. So he explains how each of them hints at one of the things that's going on now with Rav. The one about the tefillin and the skin of the kosher animal is a hint that Rav maybe is not doing the right thing by leaving the holy pure land of Eretz Yisrael and coming to Babel. The one about blood being red. The one about blood being red symbolizes the trouble that he's going through, the yisurim that he's going through with the stomach ache, and the one about the orla, again following Rashi, that the point of the waves being the high waves was to protect his modesty while he's going to the bathroom over the side of the boat. So therefore, that relates to the orla, which is on that part of the body. Anyway, Omerlay. So at this point, Rav says to Karna, "My Shimcha, what's your name?" So he says, "Karna." So Rav tells him, Omale, Yehei Rava, the tipuk like Karna Be'ene. May it be Hashem's will that a Karna should come out in your eye. Meaning Rashi says at this point, he realized Karna is there only to test him and bother him. So he says that a Karna should grow on your eye. There's an explanation from the Ga'onim that's brought by the Rishonim that a Karna is a kind of growth, like a cataract or like literally Karna means a horn. So it means, in other words, that there should be a growth in his eye as a punishment, basically, for harassing Rav like that. The fact is, you know, fine, he has to check, as Shmuel told him, whether he's a Gavir Rav, but he doesn't have to go to this extent, especially when he's asking him things that seemingly are impossible, like the question, how do we know that Mila doesn't take place on the heart? So Rav already is a little annoyed by that, and he says this. In fact, actually, there's a Gemara in Bava Basra that mentions that at one point Shmuel was also upset with Karna. The Gemara tells that at one point Shmuel sent Karna to establish a certain halacha in the marketplace, and Karna instead did differently than Shmuel, and Shmuel said the same thing to him, Yehei Rav, the typical Karna Be'enei. So Rashbam over there explains, the Rashbam that's printed on the Omud over there explains that actually both things contributed. Just Rav's statement alone, or just Shmuel's statement alone, might not have been enough for it to happen, but the combination made it actually happen. On the other hand, there's a different version of Rashbam printed on the side of the Omud over there in Bava Basra that says we take out the words over there, V'chein Hava, it didn't actually happen. Shmuel was just saying it out of annoyance to Karna, but not that it actually happened.
This Karna man was like a wise guy or a troublemaker?
Well, but the fact is he was also a great Talmid Chacham. So,
yeah.
Why would he do this? His Bepashtus were saying, you know, Shmuel told him to check out whether this is a Talmid Chacham. So he's asking him various questions in Torah to test him out. And again, like the Ben Ishchai says, in Benayahu, each of them represented something of what's going on currently with Rav, that he had left Eretz Yisrael, that he's suffering Yisurim, and that the waves helped protect his modesty while he was going to the bathroom. Okay. Anyway, continues the Gemara. Eventually, Shmuel brought Rav into his house. He gave him barley bread to eat, which helps a person, it makes a person have diarrhea. Because after all, Shmuel was a doctor, so he knew what you need in order to cure Rav's stomach trouble. He also gave him kosa dehausina, which the Gemara Rashi defines in a few places is fish fried in their own fat, together with flour, so kind of like their version of the filter fish, I guess. And the ashbi shikra, and he gave him beer to drink. All these things help make a person loose. V'loy achva le'besakise, and Shmuel did not show Rav where the bathroom is. The point is, Rashi says he wanted that all of this food that makes him more loose should be in his stomach for a while and turn over and get thoroughly digested. That way, when he does go to the bathroom, it'll clean him out completely, and that way it'll take care of his stomach trouble. But Rav did not realize that that's why Shmuel is doing that. The reason is so you should have diarrhea and you should be able to completely clean out. But Rav didn't realize that. So Rav cursed the Omer and he said, "Manda mitzaron, whoever it is that's harassing me and causing me pain like that, loy loik me le boni, may he not have children whose sons survive. And that's how it was that Shmuel, in fact, we find in a number of places where the Gemara mentions Shmuel's daughters, but apparently he didn't have any sons who survived him because of what Rav said. In fact, Ben Yehoyada says, why would Rav say such a thing? He thought that maybe as a result of what he said to Kauna before, maybe Kauna went to Shmuel's house and convinced the people over there to keep harassing Rab. So therefore he was very upset over the way they're treating him. The Gemara elsewhere mentions, by the way, that eventually Rab realized that he'd made a mistake, that he'd been choshed to Kshirim. The result was, the Gemara says, that in a couple of places, that even though Rab was a much greater Talmud Chacham than Shmuel, and he was also older than him, there's a couple of places where it mentions that from then on, Rab showed extra cover to Shmuel when they were together in a place because of this, because by mistake he had cursed him with a negative thing like this. Okay, Yom Yom Mashiach HaGola. Of Dalad ear. So continuing, we started talking about yesterday an excerpt from a sicha where the Rebbe talks about the lasid lovi, we won't need show to him because everybody will be listening to the shoftim. Now, on the other hand, everything in Torah is eternal. So that means lasid lovi, there still will be the shoftim b'shoitrim b'chol sharecha. But the shoitrim will only be lamal yusad, only be for good purposes, namely that their job will be to announce that the shofet is there and help the Jewish people fulfill what the Beis Din is telling them. For example, let's say the shoitrim will have the job, let's say, of straightening out and clearing the roads for the Edim who see the new moon so that they can get to Beis Din as fast as possible and as easy as possible to testify. So that'll be the job of the shoitrim rather than what we have in earlier times where they actually have to force people to listen to the Beis Din. Continuing on halachas of Birkas HaRe'iyah, if a person sees a chacham gadol b'Torah who is a yid, then he says a bracha shecholak mechachmasi l'reiv. Why shecholak? Because the Jewish people are chelak elikam imal. So therefore, we use the expression shecholak that Hashem, so to speak, gave them a portion. If he sees a chacham gadol in the sciences from the umas ha'olam, then instead he makes the bracha shenosa mechachmasi l'bosav adam that Hashem gave of his chachma to a human being. So there we don't say l'yireiv because the goyim are not yireiv, and we don't say shecholak either. Rather shenosa, as though it's like a third party that Hashem gave them. Yes.